everybody. It's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Transformative Taskmaster Podcast, the podcast by fans, for fans, and about fans. This week, the horn section's Ben Reynolds is on, talking music, Glastonbury, and what it was like to work with Frankie Boyle. As a note, we had some significant technical difficulties this episode, so please forgive the occasional strange cut.
All right, well, welcome Ben Reynolds to the Transformative Taskmaster podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, very excited to have you here. We've now collected four of you. I think we're still missing Will and Ed. Need to reach out to me, but it's exciting.
You're slowly, you're kind of working your way down from the most organized to the least organized.
Well,
I think everyone would think that's fair to say.
Well, which is funny because Joe was the first one to reach out to me. And I feel like as a trumpet player, that's not generally the most organized first, but
yeah. I know what you mean. He's got an air. Joe's very chilled, but I think he's sort of quietly quite organized.
Yeah.
And sometimes Joe's very busy, and sometimes Joe has some time on his hands. I feel the rest of us, because we do, most of us in the band do some teaching, we often find our time gets quite filled up. And I think Joe and Mark as well, they're often like either crazy busy with something on the go, or they've got a nice bit of time free. Having said that, they've both got children, so they don't really have time free, but you know.
Right, yeah. Relative time.
Yeah, exactly. Relative time with the relatives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we know, obviously, that you and Joe and Alex were the original members, quote unquote, of the horn section, more or less, because you three grew up together. Can you tell us, like, from your perspective, like, how the horn section came to be?
Yeah. I guess it had its roots in, like you say, the three of me, Joe, and Alex meeting when we were babies, basically. So I think my mum met Alex's mum first through Alex's dad, who was a GP, who was also our GP. And then they got introduced, and then they also met Joe's mum. And I reckon we were probably roughly about 3 years old at this point. And then it turned out years later, like, we were the middle three of three children, and then it ended up that we were in three families who ended up having three boys, and we were all the middle, the awkward nightmare middle children. And we hung out lots. Alex went to a lovely posh school. Joe and I carried on trundling on in our normal schools. And then we always hung out and went on holidays, and families spent loads of time with each other. We all went off to university, and we still stayed in touch, but maybe not quite as much. And then Mark, who was also kind of a bit friends with Alex through us, invited him to come and do a comedy set at Ronnie Scott's. Have you heard of Ronnie Scott's?
Yeah.
Jazz club in London. Okay. So he did a set in London, I think in between some a band that Mark plays with called Soul Family.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, and I think they maybe mixed up a bit of music and a comedy. And Mark said, we should do a show. So we slung together a show, and it really was a slung together show. We went up to the Edinburgh Festival, and we had, I think we had one, no, we had two songs. We had a game, which was a game of battleships, and we played battleships. Do you have battleships?
Yeah, yeah.
In the States?
Yes.
Right. So we played battleships with the audience, and we had a song that went along with it, like a sort of 1980s rock power song that we played along with it. And then we also had a song to finish the show, which was called Friends Forever. And that was it. We literally had two songs. And the rest of it was just inviting comedians along to busk with us.
Mm-hmm.
So we just had fun. And it was amazing. That first year, we did 8 gigs. 4 at the beginning of the festival, 4 at the end. And we had Jimmy Carr come along. We had Al Murray. I don't know how many of these guys you know.
Yeah.
Tim Minchin, I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Had some amazing comics. And it was on late at night. So everyone had had a few drinks. Audience, band. Tim Key was in a lot of those shows. And we just mucked about. It was brilliant. It was the best time.
Nice.
And that kind of set it up. And I think slowly from that, we came up with a show where we invited guests along to busk along with us. And then we started writing more and more of our own stuff. And then one day Alex said, I think we need to do a show without guests. So we did it. We took the plunge. And that's kind of where we're at now. I feel like I've done a very long answer.
No, it's
to a
good
question. I can't quite remember what the question was, but this is where we're at now.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. And I mean, so we talked to Mark and Joe so far about this. And I think I was telling Mark, and I know you said you've done some teaching, and I know Mark does a little bit of teaching, but like he got started really early in the whole, like, just gigging for a living, which is really hard to do as a musician. Like, not all of us are lucky to do that. But I think with the way that you guys are allowed to kind of do your horn section tours and the podcast and the TV show, it just looks like a lot of fun. So
I think my feelings are, and I think this is probably how we all feel, I think we feel quite spoilt with the situation we've ended up in.
Mm-hmm.
I know people say, oh, you know, no one's just lucky. But I think we have been very lucky.
Right.
And I think there was a long time where we did do a lot of gigs for no money, and we put a lot of time into it. But having said that, we're under no illusions. We're not the Beatles, and we're not Monty Python. And so I think we feel very lucky to be where we're at, going on stage with our best mates, basically being a bunch of idiots, which is playing ourselves. So that fits very well. And we get, you know, paid a living. That's incredible.
Yeah. Ideal.
Yeah. It feels great.
Awesome.
Yeah. It is ideal.
Sweet. So when did you start playing your instrument? Was it like early primary school days?
Yeah, it was with Joe. We had a band. Did Joe tell you about Matrix?
I think he may have mentioned it.
So we had a band. I'm sure you've heard of us. We played some pretty hard-hitting jazz covers in our school. We had a trio with myself, Joe, and a keyboard player. And then Joe's brother joined us on bass. We were called Matrix. And yeah, it was pretty heavy. We changed some stuff. We played a wedding, and we played in some local pubs in the West Sussex area, which is in the south of England. My dad was our manager, and that was sort of the start of my musical journey. I think it always felt to me like Joe was a little step ahead of me. He went off to music college.
Mm-hmm.
The year before I left to go to university, I took a year out.
Mm-hmm.
And worked in a factory and practiced the drums. And I think Joe probably made me realize, oh, you could do this, you could make a career out of it. So I think it was quite useful having him as a friend at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's very nice to describe him as useful, but it was very useful.
Yeah.
And he moved up to London. And then the year later, I lived with Joe. I moved into a house with him in London with a few other musicians. And I've lived with Joe in a few different houses. We bought a house together about 10 years ago. Well, maybe 12 years ago now. And we've lived with Will in the house. Joe lived with Mark for quite a while. I think he might have lived with Will as well. We've basically all trialed living with each other for a while.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. So did you always play drums, or did you ever learn any other instruments?
I played a little bit of piano in this band we set up called Matrix. Don't know if I mentioned this band. Matrix is incredible, incredible band. And, I played a little bit of piano, and then along came this other guy who actually played piano. So we realized I couldn't play piano anymore. So you can see how my path to drums was created. I just didn't play piano as well as the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd heard me mucking around on the drums, and they're like, well, you could just do that. And I was like, okay. So I sort of fell into it. That was it, really. It was more of a necessity. It was more the fact that we couldn't have two keyboard players, a trumpet and a bass. We needed someone to get on kit.
Mm-hmm.
So off I went, the worst of two pianists.
So was drum kit, because I majored in music education, so I had to learn to play like all the instruments, and for the life of me, I was not coordinated enough to play the drum kit. I loved everything, like timpani, it was like my favorite thing ever to play, but yeah, drum kit was too many limbs going at once, so it was too difficult for me. So did you pick it up pretty easily, or was that something that you were like, oh, this is hard?
I think relatively easily. Yeah. I don't remember a time when it felt too unnatural.
That's good.
But yeah, I guess I enjoyed it. So that was probably the thing. But I guess that's the thing I find with my teaching, that if the kid I'm teaching enjoys it,
mm-hmm.
that's more than half the battle.
Yeah, for sure.
And then they're in it and they want to learn it. And I think that was probably where I was at. I just loved the drums. And so I just kept playing them.
Nice.
And so after a while, I guess that was it.
So is it mostly just kit these days, or had you ever played, you know, percussion in like a community band or a school band or anything?
Yeah.
Like that?
I've done a little bit of orchestrally stuff, but I definitely wouldn't class myself as a percussionist. And I definitely wouldn't get phoned up to do that kind of work.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't classically trained. Mm-hmm. So I don't have that string to my bow, really. I did dabble in some youth bands and orchestras, which was useful, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
It was good to learn to read music.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of my learning to read music happened after university.
Oh, interesting.
Just going out on gigs and people just throwing music in front of you, and mm-hmm. you just have to do it.
Yeah.
And so I did learn to read music at university, but you know, that difference between really learning and feeling like that's what you can do,
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, just sort of desperately making your way through something.
So what did you major in?
So I studied jazz. Well, it was music brackets jazz.
Okay.
So I think all of us in the band have got our roots in jazz, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most of us either studied or loved playing. And actually, Joe might have mentioned, so Joe, Ed, Will, and myself all played in a septet that Will used to run called the Will Collier Septet.
Original.
Yeah. and we did two albums, I think, with that band. That was really fun. jazz stuff, mostly Will's compositions. It's really lovely.
Cool.
Actually, if you have you checked it out at all?
No, that's the first time I've heard of it. So I'll write it down and go check it out.
You should check it out.
Yeah,
it's lovely music. So we had another connection. We've had a few different musical connections along the road to where we are now, I guess.
Yeah, that's cool. It's kind of weird to think that you wouldn't have learned how to read music if you majored in music. But I guess most people, if they're majoring in music, you kind of already either know how to play music or you don't. So,
yeah. I mean, I did, but I think it was that thing like, do you drive? Do you drive a car?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I reckon it's the difference between, you know, like when you're having driving lessons and you pass your tests, hopefully you pass your test, and then that day where you get released out on your own in the car and you think, oh, crap.
I don't know anything.
I don't know anything about driving and I'm on my own in a car. Now I'm going to learn to drive. And that's, I feel like that's the moment with leaving university for me. It was like, okay, now I'm really reading music because it matters.
Yeah.
And you feel like no one's next to you going, no, do it like this. No, that bit wasn't right. Go back and look at that bit. It's just you're on your own.
Hi.
Either you get it or you don't.
My cat says hi. Oh.
Oh, hello, cat. What's your cat called?
Her name is Peel Pal. It's Hebrew for pepper because she's spicy. I know.
Nice.
I know, sweetie. My dad, well, both of my parents are musicians, but my dad played string bass, and he played in like a couple wedding bands for many, many, many years as I was growing up, and he never really learned how to read music properly. So he was just like, just learn it by ear, and he plays like hundreds of songs by ear, which I've always been really impressed by, but
yeah, well, that's often the way, I think, if people don't read music, they do develop often amazing oral capabilities. Yeah. They can pick stuff up so fast.
Yeah.
Which I think probably, especially maybe for the sort of classical world of musicians who are incredible readers and incredible technicians, They're often so wowed by seeing a jazz musician pick up something that quickly.
Yeah,
they're like, "Oh, how do you do that? How do you know? How do you?" But like, I marvel at the guys in the band. Their harmony, the way they can pick up stuff so quick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can hear it. They know straight away what's going on.
Yeah, it's which definitely is why I'm the drummer. Right now, I feel like usually a drummer doesn't like necessarily sing a lot. And obviously in the horn section specifically, you kind of have to, like, all of you sing a lot. Was that something that you were kind of thrown into and they were like, we're all singing this and you have to deal with it? Or was that something that like you've always kind of been singing anyway?
I think I'd done a bit of singing. So Joe and I used to play in a bluegrass band called the Wagon Tails. And that was my first real sort of foray into what I guess we call singing. And we would just sit. It was when we used to live together and we would sit in the house with Joe had just picked up banjo and I would have a snare drum and we'd have another guy on double bass. And we would try and learn three-part harmonies for like simple bluegrass songs. And at the time, it felt like the hardest thing ever. But it was that was the best workout for getting some kind of singing chops together.
Mm-hmm.
And just getting over that thing of singing.
Yeah.
You know, that classic, I'm not a singer, the imposter syndrome of it.
Yeah.
None of us in the band would ever say we're great singers. But I guess we've got better. And we're happy to give it a go.
And that's what matters, right?
Yeah. And I think, well, there's a lot to be said for feeling comfortable with doing it. And if you feel a bit more comfortable, you do it better. And I'm not saying our better is any good, but it's not too far off acceptable.
Yeah.
It's it's borderline. We'll take it.
Now, do
I enjoy
you,
it now.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Do you know what your vocal range is? Like, are you a bass or a berry or
I know
tenor?
I don't know. I haven't got a clue what I am. I know my intonation is creative and my range is broad.
Well,
I've got a really
good.
Big range. I know that.
Yeah, that's good.
I can go very low and I can go very high, but it's all way out of tune.
You love to see it. Yeah. Okay, now this technically this is a Taskmaster fan podcast. So let's talk a little bit about Taskmaster,
sure.
And then we'll go back to some horn section stuff. So
yeah.
we always love seeing when you guys are on Taskmaster, because we'll be like, hey, we know those guys.
yeah.
I'm thinking especially of the task in series 15 when you had to make an instrument, or the contestant had to make an instrument, and then you had to work with them.
Yeah.
So I think you were with Frankie.
Yeah, Frankie Boyle. Yeah.
Yeah, Frankie Boyle, and he made some drums, and then he kind of had to instruct you on how he wanted them to sound, and then you had to play that.
Yeah.
So what was that process like?
Frankie Boyle. Yeah, he was interesting. He wasn't. I don't think he was hugely musical, so I think there was a lot of sort of pointing to certain drums and just going, play that one, do that one, no, faster. He just wanted me to do everything really fast, I remember, which isn't, I think he said to me, as fast and as loud as you can, which isn't, it's not the nicest thing to do as a musician. You don't want to be stretched to your crazy limit.
Yeah.
But he's great, and he was very lovely. And I thought he made a very good drum kit.
Cool. Yeah,
He did some good miming.
Yeah.
There was a nice bit that they actually cut, I think, from the show, which was, I guess, you know, that's probably the problem with a show like that. They probably end up with so much good material. But he'd built this drum kit out of these tubs and pots and pans. I think there was an oil drum in there. And then he did the take with me. So they literally walk onto set. They're told what they do. Everything you see is as it is. There's no like reruns or anything like that. And he did the take, and whatever it was, 7-8 minutes later, walked off set. And just at that point, the drum kit just collapsed. It just fell apart. And I thought it was so perfect. But, he didn't. That was it. I don't think it actually went into the show, because I guess they had enough other good stuff. But it was quite a nice. It was quite a nice moment.
That's funny. Yeah, I guess it's a pretty quick process. Then you're kind of in and out in like half an hour.
So fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing for me, like, which is always the drummer's thing, is it's getting there and it's setting up your huge drum kit,
mm-hmm.
and then you do your thing, and then it's packing down your drum
kit,
and it's sort of like a minor version of moving house every day, and then setting your house up in someone else's house, and then taking it all home again. I should have just done what Frankie did, just picked up a few pots and pans. Perfect, saved a lot of time.
Yeah, as a trumpet player, we get it pretty easy, because we can just take our stuff everywhere. But with the bigger instruments, and I think drums is the worst, honestly, because even with a bass, you can just roll the one thing. And with a piano,
it's just a one thing,
or you just play whatever keyboard they have at the location. But
drums is just the right or wrong side. It's just on the side where people thought, yeah, you can get that into an estate car. You can bring that. it's just over the border.
Yeah.
And all the other instruments fall just the other side. Like, everyone goes, no, you can't get a piano in a car. So we'll get you a piano.
Yeah.
But
what a pain.
What a pain. I don't mind it.
Well, that's good. So let's talk about the horn section TV show. So series 2 just came out, which was really exciting. So what was it like playing a fictionalized version of yourself on the TV show? And what are the differences and similarities between your character and real life?
I don't know if there are any differences? I don't think any of us played anything other than just sort of ourselves. Yeah. I guess we were slightly trumped up versions of ourselves, but I mean, yeah, I really think we were just ourselves, just being silly and mucking about. And yeah, Alex wrote the script, and he wrote a brilliant script, and we all there. If we had a line or something else funny we thought we could put in, we might. But generally, what you see is what Alex wrote, and I don't know how much we were able to inhabit other characters. I think we were generally pretty much who we are.
Nice.
Apart from the point where they would just say to you, I think you're feeling a bit nervous in this scene, or you're a bit mm-hmm. upset, or that, and we go, oh, okay, I think I know what you mean. And then we'd just do what we did. We did have acting lessons. Did the other guys tell you about this?
Yeah. Yeah, like, it was, what, yeah. like an hour worth of... acting yeah. lessons or something.
Yeah, which I think is what Rafe Fiennes and on all the guys, Alec Guinness, I think all these guys probably had a week's worth of acting lessons like we did. I think the acting lessons was really helpful to just be in a room and be acting in front of each other.
Right.
That's what felt quite alien in the beginning.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit like the singing thing,
mm-hmm.
just learning to just do it and feel a bit more comfortable doing it, because we all knew we weren't going to win Oscars, but that was sort of that was fine. We just wanted to get through it and do it as well as we could and hopefully enjoy it on the way. I think the second series we definitely enjoyed that process more, because
mm-hmm.
I guess we felt a bit more comfortable.
Yeah, you get used to it, and all the cameras pointed at you are a little more in the background, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely that. There was the first series, I remember vividly, there was a scene with myself and Will on the sofa, and we were talking to Tim Key, who was like the band's sort of psychiatrist, yeah. therapist guy. Yeah. And that was mine and Will's first, like, proper scene where we were sat acting, and I guess more to the point, away from our instruments. And we both walked off set that day, and he said how was that for you? I said, I think I had a panic attack. He said, yeah, I think I did too. I think I had about an hour and a half panic attack. It was absolutely terrifying, because
yeah.
we'd never done it before. And all of a sudden, like you say, you've got all these cameras pointing at you, mm-hmm. and you just have to do it. I think if you're ever going to feel imposter syndrome, that's the moment. But then after a while, we started to realize, oh, it's actually quite fun. And we're all together, so it doesn't matter. It's all fine. Yeah, I enjoyed it now. I'd like to do more of it, but we'll see.
Now, recently you guys were at Glastonbury, which looked like a lot yeah. of fun.
That was great.
Yeah, I saw some pictures and some videos, and I saw the new outfits that you guys had.
Wowee.
Yeah, wowee yeah. is right.
So what did you think?
Well, I loved them. I thought it was great. I was not expecting them at all. And then it made me kind of wonder, like, who decides your outfits for the shows? Because, like, obviously, like, the shirt I'm wearing is, like, the big rainbow sparkly thing. And I think Alex yeah. recently got, like, a different version of it. It's long sleeves and it's more white than black.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
a little, like, changing it up a little bit. But, like, who decides what the outfits are going to be?
I think if anyone's got an idea for things like that, then people will listen. I think there are people in the band who probably just don't care, which actually is quite useful when there's six of you.
Yeah.
If you're trying to make a decision, if you've got two or three of you that just don't care,
mm-hmm.
that's really good. Because then the people who do care can actually have quite a simple discussion about it. But I think I probably care quite a lot about aesthetics. And I think, so I get quite excited about the set and what we might look like. I think Alex actually came up with these outfits you're talking about.
Yeah.
The spangly shirts. I think it's quite a nice touch, the one you're wearing, because it's got all the colours of the rainbow. Mm. And when we do the show, we're all in a different colour. So yeah. It's almost like Alex is everything coming together in the middle, which is a nice, I like that sentiment.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure the sort of tassely leotards at Glastonbury. I don't know if I feel the same way. It felt like a fun thing to do for the festival.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll do it again. Maybe other festivals. Yeah. We'll see.
I mean,
Alex said, it was all Alex. Alex said, I bought these. And we're like, okay. He said, I think you should wear them to Glastonbury. And we're like, okay. And then I think we all hoped that he would forget that he'd mentioned it. And then we were literally backstage and he just whips out all these outfits. We're like, great. Okay. So in we hop. Oh, God.
Oh, my gosh.
It was so hot.
It looked really hot.
It was really hot. And we had these under our normal outfits. So, it's telling me my Mac's going to go to sleep, which is not helpful because I don't have a socket now. Where can I plug this? Bear with me one second.
Okay.
I'm going to solve this. I'm going to go and get a multi-plug thing.
All right.
I think that should work. Yeah, we're on. We're back in. Sorry about that.
All right. No worries. Yeah, it was funny because we knew that you would be playing at Glastonbury, but we obviously, nobody told us about the outfits, so we were like, what are these? Yeah. Where did these come from?
Yeah, I don't know where they came from. I'm going to guess it was Amazon.
Yeah.
I don't know where they are now. The last time I saw them, they were soaking wet, and they were going into a carrier bag. And I like to think that they've been laundered and given to a charity shop somewhere for someone else to enjoy.
Nice.
That's my hope.
Well, it was a lovely, sparkly surprise that we all loved.
Yes.
you pulled them off very well. You all did.
Yeah, well, we pulled them off. We took them off immediately.
Oh, man. All right. So, as somebody who doesn't necessarily, you know, read a lot of sheet music, and obviously you do a lot of improvisation, are there any horn section songs that you're able to improvise more on when you do them live than others, or is it all mostly across the board?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think mostly for the horn section songs, I would say we sort of come up with parts and they fit the song as we feel. Well, we play what we feel the song requires. And I think for the most part, we would probably stick to the part. I think probably when we started out doing a horn section, it was probably a little more jazz based than it is. And although we still probably sound like a jazz band playing these songs, it's not really jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel the most important thing we would always feel is that the song has to shine through. It's all about the words. So if the music's getting too busy or getting in the way, then something has to change, you know. So I'd say generally, like, are there any which are a little bit improvisatory? Yeah, not massively, although we're sort of playful within the form a little bit, but I wouldn't say there's a moment where we go off on one.
Mm-hmm.
and anyone gets like a crazy solo like you might in jazz and you really roll with it for ages, because it's a bit harder to do it on this gig. It's very hard to describe things, I find. Like, you know, what can you do apart from go, well, it's a little bit this and it's a little bit that. I find that very hard if someone says to me, well, what's it about? So what do you do? You do funny songs, like what? Like what kind of stuff? And you're like, well, so is it Monty Python? Well, No, not really, but maybe a bit of that.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band? Did they ever make it to the States?
No.
They were a band we used to listen to when we were younger. They're sort of a silly, crazy, out there band, and I used to love their music. And I sort of wish I like to think we're a little bit like them, because they wrote absolutely bizarre, bonkers songs, and they're great fun. But yeah, but most people haven't heard of them, so that's
Yeah.
that.
I feel like for me, the closest thing to compare it to is kind of like Weird Al, even though you don't,
Right.
I mean, he mostly does like covers, or not covers, what's the word? Oh my gosh. I'm blanking, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Where, he'll take a song and then he'll change the lyrics. I know there was a word for it. I'm just not.
Yeah, like reworking, sort of reimagining
Yeah.
songs.
Parody, that's what it's called. Yeah. So he'll do a lot of parody songs, which isn't necessarily what you guys do, because I feel like most of your stuff is original songs. But the vibe is very similar, I think. Yeah. All right, so we're gonna do a little game. And then I have a couple more questions, and then we'll get out of here. And maybe
No
I'll
worries.
leave my apartment so that I don't have to listen to this fire alarm keep going
Yeah.
off. Okay, so this game is called Quick Fire Questions, and the only rule is that you have to answer using one word answers. So I'll ask you a question, but your answer can only be one word. Okay. Here we go. Quick fire questions. Best genre of music.
World.
You're at a horn section rehearsal and the group needs to split off into pairs. Who are you taking as your partner?
Ed.
If you had to swap instruments with somebody else, what instrument would you take?
Bass.
If you could get a tattoo, what would it be?
Oh. Moon.
The song that you have the most fun playing.
People.
Technically, only one word. Do you, I think I know the answer to this one, but do you prefer to be called a percussionist or a drummer?
Drama.
If the horn section got into a pub fight, who would win?
Ed.
Best drummer in the world.
Brian.
Okay, great. That's the end of the game section. you want to expand on your last answer?
No, I want people to think, I want people to try and work out who I'm talking about.
Amazing. Okay, good.
I want to hear if there's any guesses.
Sounds good. All right, good. Now I've talked to Joe and Mark already, and they, I think, decided that Joe writes the most songs, and then
Yes,
probably
Joe's top
Will next, and then maybe Mark after. But do you have a favorite song that you've written for the horn section?
I think it would. Joe wrote the music for it, but I wrote the lyrics for Granddaddy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and I don't think I'll ever write anything as funny as that ever again.
Yeah.
I think I knew as I was writing it, I think my daughter's just stuck her head round. Yeah, so I think, yeah, that's probably the song which I'm most proud of,
Yeah.
because it kind of wrote itself. I woke up at 4 in the morning and had the idea, and went into the spare room and just scribbled it out, and it was written in like 20 minutes, half an hour, I think.
Nice.
And then the last verse, we kind of all came up with on a gig. I don't know. Do you know the song?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So the herpes line, that came later. Uh-huh. We had a stage manager and we were talking to her about, I can't remember what it was. It was like, has she gone and bought some peas? And someone said, or is she using herpes? It was something like that. And then yeah. we all suddenly twigged. And we're like, well, that's the next verse.
Yeah.
And Joe actually wrote the last verse for that. So I wrote like the first bits. And Joe wrote that last verse.
Nice.
And then he put some music on it.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you write Record Player?
Yes.
Yeah. I love that one.
Oh, we haven't done that for years. That's nice to hear. I'd forgotten about that song.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. Because I think it's hard to keep track of who has written what. Although I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, we kind of assume that whoever is singing the main bit on the song is usually the one who wrote it.
Yeah, like the Beatles.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, there's a lot of parallels to be drawn. I think that's sort of true, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's not as true as, like, I think, I can't believe I'm trying to draw a parallel with the Beatles. But with the Beatles, like, I think that was almost 100%. Like, if Paul sang it, Paul had written it.
Right.
I think that was the way it went. But I think that's less the case with us, especially now. I think now, because we think about the show, and so let's say Joe's written a song that we think, actually, that would work really well for Ed to sing that one.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, Joe definitely has been more prolific in the last couple of years. So I think if he'd written a couple of good songs, rather than Joe singing most of the songs in a set,
mm-hmm.
we would go, oh, well, let's give that one to Ed or give that one to Will.
Yeah.
I think often I'll come up with maybe more of an idea kind of song,
mm-hmm.
like the Record Player thing. Yeah.
Nice.
Silly idea. Yeah.
So other than Granddaddy and Record Player, are there other songs that you've written that you can just list off the top of your head?
Oh, crikey. There's quite a lot, because we force each other to write these songs for the podcast.
Oh, and your podcast song that you did with the write a song about your one of your parents' friends.
Oh, yeah.
That was really good. I really loved all of yours. Like, they were really, really funny. Oh, yeah, those were good.
Yeah, I wrote that about my parents' friend, Graham Phillips. I can't remember what I said about him. Yeah, I'll have to get back to you on that. It's funny. I think when you're in it, writing a song, it feels like such a massive thing, and you're just in that world, mm-hmm. and then if it doesn't go, like, often we categorize things very quickly. We either say, oh, that's a good one for the podcast,
mm-hmm.
which means it's okay, but it ain't great.
Right.
Or if it's really good, then it's like, ah, that could go into the live show.
Yeah.
So, and if it falls into that podcast category, like, well, the other songs still go in the podcast, but the podcast songs don't go in the live show.
Right.
So they do kind of disappear into the ether a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
They might end up on an album, but
yeah,
we probably won't play them again.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay. I have just a couple more. So on this podcast, like, we're all about, like, the fandom side of Taskmaster, and I guess also the Horn section, now that I've interviewed like four of you. but so talk to me a little bit about your experience with, like, the fans that show up to Horn section gigs. Like, what kind of people are they? And like, what are your experiences like at the, if you ever do the merch booth? I forget who always runs the merch booth. I feel like it's
Joe and Mark to run it. We've got the hard-nosed businessman and the lovely cuddly Joe. We've got the sort of polar opposites in the band, and it works well, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, and Will helps out on the admin side now because he's very tall. People can see him from a long way. They know where the stand is.
Yeah.
Generally, I'm in charge of packing up drums because if we all want to get down the pub to have a drink, we all need to think of the most efficient way to get packed down. So I will do the drums. Ed will often stay on stage and pack up Joe's and Mark's stuff. I think maybe Will's as well, put it into cases. The other guys go out and meet people.
Mm-hmm.
But then, we'll meet fans at the stage door after a gig, and they're absolutely lovely. They're the best people because they're so interested and warm and friendly. And I think this has got a lot to do with maybe Alex. I think people who enjoy Taskmaster seem to just be very friendly, warm, open people. And I think he attracts that. And you sort of notice in the shows, no one really heckles.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, there's not that kind of vibe going. There's not that kind of atmosphere. No one's trying to trip him up because I think everyone's genuinely interested and loves Alex and what he does. So I think it's a lovely thing. He attracts very nice people, which is great. And also, like, children and grandparents. It's like anyone enjoys watching Taskmaster. I think that's the nicest thing about it. So it feels to me really inclusive.
Yeah.
And so it's the kind of show that I think everyone gets something out of, which is lovely.
Nice. Have you ever been... or do you have like a favorite like gift that a fan has given you, or like a piece of fan art or fan work that you've
someone like had made an incredible, it was almost like a tapestry.
My friend Joe.
Really?
Yeah.
It was incredible. It blew our minds.
It's like a quilted, or not quilted blanket, but like a, I forget if it's crochet or something, but I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh my word. That just blew my mind. Like, we've had lovely little, very thoughtful things, which is very sweet. And I've got, I think I was looking on my mantelpiece, I've got a couple of things up there, like sweet little things that people have given us. But that for me just took the biscuit. It was just,
it's really awesome. Impressive. And
you looked at that and thought, you've spent a lot of time doing that, and it's not just the time, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's an incredible thing to see.
Very cool. Did Joe ever give you guys the little key rings that I made you?
Yes.
Okay, good. I was like, I don't know.
Got those.
I don't know how much luggage you have and if these will get lost or whatever. Did he show
you the little
piece of art that my friend made?
I don't know if he did.
Oh, he should show you. It's in my like shadow box, so I can't really get it. But it's like a, if you know what like a rubber hose style of cartoon is, like we're thinking like really old, you know, like Mickey Mouse type of, but it's like, it's a piece of fan art with the whole band, and it has like the horn section, but it's all in rubber hose style. It's really cool. Yeah. So tell him to show you, or I can probably email you. Cause it's really good. Yeah.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah. It's really
good. He only lives at the end of my road.
So oh, nice.
I can pop over.
Yeah. Yeah. Go bother him.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend from, they live in New York City, but they mocked that up, and then they sent me two. So I have one up on my, I have like a Taskmaster horn section art like area. And then the other one went to Joe with like a little note for the band. So he should definitely.
I've got to see it.
Yeah,
right.
Definitely share that with you guys.
Awesome. Yeah. Nice.
Cool. And then, okay, so we're going to wrap up here. But the horn section is back on tour, I think, through November. Is that right?
Yeah. We've got a little period in the summer where we sort of hang out with our families and have a bit of time. And then I think our first gig back's in September at some point.
Yes.
I should be able to fling out adverts and stuff at this point, but I can't do that because I don't know what I'm doing.
That's fair enough. You've got other people to do that for you.
Yeah, we do, which is lovely because I'm rubbish at that stuff. But you can definitely find out if you go to our website, or I'm sure somehow the kids find out things, right?
Yeah, totally. Then the Horn Section podcast part one is done and out now. I assume part two is coming at some point.
Podcast was that, sorry? You yes. broke up a little bit there.
Yeah, the podcast.
Yes.
Because I feel like maybe it was Alex told me you're trying to do three a year or four a year or something like that.
Yeah, we've been sort of, I'm going to give you a tiny little teaser here. We've been lightly flirting with the idea of doing some live podcasts, but we don't know if we will or not. We're just trying to find out how that could work.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
But we thought it could be really fun. I don't think necessarily in sort of a concert hall way. I think if we did do it, we want to somehow retain some of that connection with the audience, mm-hmm. and make it really fun and engaging and not just a sort of stadium podcast.
Right.
But we'll see. I think we're gonna see if there's a way we can make that work. So maybe that might happen.
Sweet. That sounds really fun.
But there will definitely be more podcasts because we love it. And it's a great way of just giving us a boot up the backside to write material.
Yeah. Yep. Very fun. And then, of course, the Horn Section TV show season 2 is out. So go watch that. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Anything else that you want to plug? You're not touring with anybody, I assume?
I'm not really. Joe's got the big news at the moment. He's grabbed the limelight. He's around. He's doing his Oasis stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of us, I'm not sure what the other guy's doing. I'm doing some really great teaching at a school in Hampstead.
Nice.
So if anyone wants to learn about more about my teaching, drop me a line and I'll tell you my name. No, I do some jazz gigs around the country. I play with a pianist called Joe Stilgoat and we do some really fun gigs.
He was the original pianist, right? For the horn section?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So I've played with Joe for years.
Nice.
So I do that as well. And then it's sort of pick up gigs and a bit of teaching. Yeah.
Awesome.
That's it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, that was Ben Reynolds. You can find out what he's up to by checking the links in the episode's description. Sorry, there's no longer cut for Patreon this time because all the extra time we usually have with guests got eaten up by a persistent fire alarm going off. Join us next week for the final pre-recorded episode before Series 20.